Welcome to the latest episode of the J-Pod, a High Library production. This will be the final episode of Season 2. Then we'll be taking a little break over the summer before we begin again with Season 3 in the fall. I'm your host, librarian Josh Cohen, speaking with you from the campus of Elizabethtown College in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania. In this podcast, I talk with faculty, staff, and students at the college about their recent scholarship, publications, or research projects. Today I'm pleased to welcome back novelist Kurt Smith, who appeared on our debut episode of the podcast back in 2022. He works at the college as the Assistant Director of Academic Advising and teaches in the English Department and the First Year Seminar Program. And one of his courses actually focuses on novel writing, which we'll be discussing today. He has published many individual stories and essays, as well as story collections, essay collections, and six novels. As I mentioned before, today we'll be discussing one of those novels, his most recent novel titled The Lost and the Blind, which he published last September. The novel centers on a 17-year-old boy named Mark Hayes, who lives in a very unstable family situation with a drug-addicted single mother who's often absent for long stretches of time, and a father who's in prison. And this leaves Mark to fend for himself without many resources and very limited guidance. Mark has essentially fallen through the cracks of the system and is in survival mode throughout most of the novel. So to set the stage for our discussion, I've asked Kurt to read the opening pages of the novel for us. So I'll let you go ahead and start us with the opening pages.
Okay. Well, thank you, Josh. Thanks for having me. All right. This is the opening two pages of The Lost and the Blind. By the end of summer, the summer of the farmhouse and Amy and her baby, my mother no longer makes a secret of shooting up. She's never been discreet. I've long known the truth behind closed doors, but since coming here, she's brought her needle and works into the open. That may sound dire, but this is not the case. Indeed, these past few months with Amy are as close as my childhood has gotten to idyllic. I have a bed, not a sofa or a spot on the floor, and a room all my own and a door to shut. There are chickens, a grass-nibbling goat, the farmhouse we share an island, and around us an ocean of green alfalfa that distances us from the man who threatened to kill my mother, and, as an afterthought, me. I stand eating a turkey leg in the kitchen doorway. My mother and Amy brush past, each carrying what calls them and trailing the scents of cigarettes and rain. They settle onto the couch. They wear their catering outfits, their most recent stopgap gig, black slacks and vests, white ruffled shirts, our penguin suits, my mother joked, but at the moment no one's laughing. My mother with her spoon and shot glass and candle, Jesus, she spits, a curse for her tremors, for Amy's bawling baby, a curse for the exit she can't make fast enough. Amy cradles little Grace and her free hand fumbles with her blouse and bra. I should look away, but I don't. Grace latches on and the room fills with a soft static. The babies suckle. The rain in the fields and the sizzle of cooking junk. The man who threatened to kill us died last weekend. This fact brings me peace, but not joy, and the knowing his fix could have just as easily ended up in my mother's arm makes him feel both alive and near. We arrived at Amy's the day after Christmas and one step ahead of our own bad luck. The sun bright and the snow's pain glare. The car crammed with the things we'd shoved in the garbage bags. What we couldn't fit left behind. Halfway down the farmhouse lane, our car got stuck, so we trudged ahead. The drifts up to our knees, our thighs. My garbage bag ripped and I struggled but was never quite able to corral the spill. My mother forged on, stumbling, righting herself, never looking back. The sun glinted on the snub-nosed .38 she'd stolen from the man we were escaping. I had no gloves and my mother had no coat. The distance between us grew. We neared the farmhouse, but it still looked small, swallowed by white and blue and a sun that offered no warmth. A woman stepped onto the porch and my mother announced our arrival by lifting the .38 to the cloudless sky and squeezing off a round.
All right. Well, thank you for reading that. So since you've started by reading us the opening of the novel, I thought I would ask you about beginning a novel or determining what's going to start the novel from the first sentence to just sort of the opening. It's got to be a challenge to decide how you're going to do that. How did you decide on this way to begin this particular story?
So this book had a different trajectory than most. That first chapter of this book was originally a short story.
Okay.
And that was accepted by a literary magazine. And then that literary magazine was a college literary magazine. And they hit a financial snag. And then COVID hit. And in the meantime, I kept thinking about this story and thinking it wanted to be a longer piece. So I withdrew it from publication and decided to start building a novel with it. And that's very rare because usually when I finish a story or a novel, you know, it's pretty dead. I never think about it again. But there was something about that opening that I kept thinking there's more to it than that. So I was kind of grateful that, you know, the publication as a short story did hit those snags and allow me some time to think about it more.
And did you end up writing the novel in chronological order?
Pretty much. When I first started putting it in novel form, the second chapter was originally the first chapter, where he's helping the old man in his house. But then I thought that wasn't enough to kind of grab people's attention at first, and I decided to stay with the short story as that. And yes,
with that opening.
But that opening, and then from there, I pretty much wrote it chronologically. Now, you know, I plan everything. I'm a big planner, so I mapped it out, but I pretty much wrote it straight through during COVID. That's when I sat down. This one was really helped by COVID, if there's such a thing as being helped by COVID.
Well, it certainly establishes the farmhouse where Mark lives and spends a good deal of time in the novel and sort of setting up that scenario, and also just the crazy living situation that he's in right from the get-go with his mother and then with the Amy character.
You know, I think it helps to have I do a lot of author interviews, and I think one of the best bits of advice I ever got was from Pam Painter, who said, you know, what we crave is that unstable situation, and from there, you know, comes conflict, and from there comes, you know, all these possibilities.
What we crave as novelists.
Yes, or as readers.
As readers. Okay.
And as far as unstable situations
go. Not in our actual lives.
No. My life is very boring, I thought. But as far as the unstable situation goes, I think we have it right there.
Absolutely. And I'm curious to know, where did your protagonist, Mark Hayes, come from? This young man who is in this situation.
So, you know, before I came here, I came here in 2017 or 2016. And before I came here, I taught high school for 33 years. And I worked with students who were often, you know, in trouble and on the periphery of things.
In a public high school.
In a public high school. Yeah. So, you know, I didn't know a particular Mark, like the kid in this book, but I knew dozens of Marks as far as like this, a little bit of this situation rings true, a little bit of this. And I think a lot of the book is based in the psychology of, you know, the children of addicts and how do they respond, you know, and they seem to go in these kind of set trajectories. You know, I'm going to make the same mistakes my parents did. I'm going to like lash out at the world. And then there's kids like Mark who want to be a peacemaker. They want to soothe the rough edges. And once I kind of had that idea, like this is Mark's psychology, this is his MO, it kind of helped guide, you know, the rest of his actions throughout the book.
Now, the world that you've constructed here is almost exactly like our own, with one notable exception. I don't know if you know where I'm going with this, but in Mark's world, there's a major war going on that's never explicitly defined. It's mostly relegated to the background of Mark's life until the very end. But could you talk about how you constructed the war in the background of the novel and how you feel like it functions in the story?
Okay, yeah, that's a good question. And I was just doing this with my novel class the other day. Most of my novels have some element in the background that builds and somehow mirrors or provides some context for what's going on in the piece. So it's kind of like a thread that you weave through, you know, a tapestry. And as you do that, you think where, you know, you don't want to overdo it, but you want to leave enough breadcrumbs throughout that, yes, there's a war going on in the background. It's just another war and endless wars that we kind of have gotten used to in the past 25 years. So it builds up and it escalates. And it gets to a tipping point near the end where it gets bigger than your typical background war. And I think we kind of can see maybe midway through the book that this is going to consume this main character. This is what's going to, he's going to go there and you know, be part of this. So a lot of it's, you know, like, I want this background element. How am I going to weave it through? Oftentimes in editing, I'll start pulling out because I overdid it. Like, I want to make this point. But a lot of it's like I wanted to escalate that thing, and I wanted to hit at certain marks throughout. So hopefully that worked.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, you know, you could have ostensibly picked an actual conflict going on, but this is clearly a fictional conflict. I think there's a reference to like jungle, kind of reminiscent of Vietnam, maybe. But
It's a South American thing.
Yeah,
Venezuela, and so yeah, it's this sort of regional action that kind of gets blown out of proportion, and you know, there's U.S. troops there protecting the embassy, and then one thing leads to another, and then there's a terrorist attack, and by the end, it's pretty much a full-fledged war.
Yeah. When we last spoke, you had mentioned that violence and poverty were themes that interested you in your fiction, and you certainly focus on them in this novel. Why do you think you're drawn to these subjects? And you kind of answered the second part to this question a little bit, but what drew you to writing about a kid struggling with poverty and a drug-addicted mother?
I know why I write about poverty. I think poverty is something that that's all around us that we don't see, or we choose not to see. And
talking about in America specifically,
America, and you know, me personally too. You know, I didn't understand poverty until, you know, I had one view of poverty growing up. It was like a very urban sort of poverty.
Did you grow up in the Philly area?
I did.
Okay,
I did. And then moving out here, you know, after having some experiences and you know, dealing with kids, and I started to realize, you know, a lot more about poverty and how it affects us and how we, you know, carry it with us and how the rest of us kind of turn or don't understand. You know, there's a lot of people out there who are hungry. You know, there's a lot of kids we give homework to that don't have a home to do homework in. So I am fascinated by that, and I like to, you know, address that in a couple books that I've done. The violence thing, I don't know. I don't know why. You know, I'm not a violent person, so but there is something I think that's fascinating about it, and I don't know if I have a good answer for what about that really works for me. It's not like the book is totally violent, and in fact, you know, if you were to ask me, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, but if you were to ask me what this book is about, I think this book is about kindness. I think the kindness is what is at the centerpiece of it, but it's balanced by a lot of other horrible stuff as well.
And the drug addiction part, I mean, opioids are obviously a huge problem in the country, affect a lot of families. Was this novel born out all out of, well, Was this novel born at all out of a concern for how our institutions just fail children and households with addiction?
Oh, for sure. I mean, I can't say that was there from the beginning, but I think that helped, you know, along the way spur me on. And part of it, I think of all the books I've written, this is probably the most that's most aligned with my political beliefs. I hope it doesn't get preachy at times. It's got a little bit of Grapes of Wrath sort of thing going on. But I don't look at people who are drug addicts as criminals. And I think we'd be better off as a society to, you know, to embrace them and love them and to, you know, offer support.
Looking at it as a sickness.
Yeah. Yeah. For sure.
Or a disease.
Yeah.
Which it is.
Yeah. And then I think it would help. I don't know. I think it would be money better spent. And the book also goes into religion for a good deal. And I think that vision of religion is truer to the word of religion. I'm not a religious person, but I think it's truer to that word to treat people that way, like the lost sheep and your lost brother, rather than, you know, just some person that's a drain on society.
Mm. Now, you had mentioned earlier that prior to coming to E-Town, you were a high school teacher for many years. Mark's high school teacher, Mr. Ford, tries to be a positive influence in his life, even though he's not a major character in the novel. How much do you relate to that character of the high school teacher trying to help this kid that the high school teacher knows he's not in the best of circumstances and is reaching out but not getting a whole lot of reciprocal feedback from Mark?
Totally. You know, that's what our job was. You know, we threw ropes, you know, extended hands, you know, all the time. And usually it wasn't reciprocated. But then it was in small ways. You know, I think when you go into teaching, when you're young, you're kind of idealistic and you think, you know, I'm going to make a difference. But I think the differences that we make are small, but they're good. You know, as long as my room was a place where my kids could feel safe and, you know, we want to hang out there instead of going to lunch or whatever, you know, I'm not getting along with this teacher. I'll come here today. But it's not like a movie. You're not going to like turn anyone's life around, but you can do it in little ways. So yes, I identified with him. I used to coach track and cross country. So I would reach out to certain kids and try to get them involved, you know, and then again, we don't make miracles, but I think that's admirable that, you know, the people that stick with the profession year after year and keep reaching out.
Now, another father figure for Mark is the character of Chief. And I thought he was a pretty interesting, unique character in the book. How did you develop the character of Chief?
Okay, so Chief has his own arc. In the beginning, Chief is kind of an antagonist to Mark. He's part of this drug addicted community.
An adult.
An adult, yes. Yeah. Oh yeah, he could be his father. He's this. Yeah. In fact, he used to hang out with this character's father. But then we see an arc with him where he kind of takes this boy. He gets sober and he kind of takes this boy under his wing, and you know, again, you know, maybe trying to right his own wrongs that he's done in his life and he's messed up his family and you know, trying to be good to someone else and for no real reason other than to be good.
Right? Yeah,
I think that's a common theme in many of my books is, you know, the struggle to be good when the only reward for being good is being good.
Yeah. Now, character that's a really poor model for Mark is the character of Amy, who's a drug addict friend of Mark's mother with whom he lives for a time in a very strange and appropriate kind of relationship. But she's a pretty unique character in the book as well. Could you talk a little bit about her role in the novel?
Okay, so Amy dominates Act One. She's a younger person than his mother, somewhere between her age and Mark's age. She's a drug addict. She's having this romantic relationship with Mark's mother. She has a baby, but she is someone who's like lost to addiction, and we see her that way. She does get sober, but she can't do it. She just can't make that work. Mark is the he's always been the most mature person in his house, you know, since he was a youngster. And that continues here. And he like loves this baby. He loves Amy for, you know, not in a romantic way. But I think she provides this sort of like, you know, the hopelessness of some people and drugs and the mistakes that we can make. And sometimes it's just one mistake and, you know, that's the only opportunity you have. I don't want to give too much away.
But, yeah, no, I understand.
But it's not good for Amy.
Now, at one point in the novel, Mark's aunt provides a potential escape route from Mark's current situation, which he passes on. And I was wondering what you think the reason is Mark chooses not to live with the stable aunt that would essentially turn around his life, potentially. Mm-hmm. Just prefers to be on his own. And
So, you're right. Mark's aunt, who is his mother's sister, took the same story the mother had and, you know, made a totally different life. And she offers to have him move in with her and go to the college where she works. So I think one thing in Mark's personality is that he's loyal and he doesn't want to leave his mother. And he sees himself here. He's a smart kid, but he sees himself, he keeps falling behind. He's never had a good high school career because when he's at school, he misses a lot of school, but when he's at school, he's worried he's going to come home and his mother will be dead, you know, from an overdose. And I just think with some students who are in this situation, there's this kind of helplessness that kind of creeps into their thinking, a kind of defeatism that creeps in. And part of it, I think, is Mark is scared. But I think a larger part is he just can't, at that time, he can't leave his mother. He doesn't want to, you know, abandon her at this time.
Mm. I like the way you sketched out the character of Mark's romantic interest in the novel, Kate. Even though she seems like a pretty positive influence in his life, she does remain on the margins of his life because of all he's dealing with. Could you talk a little bit about that relationship and crafting that character?
So I wanted to give Mark a little chance at love, you know, yeah, a little chance at a normal high school romance or just a friendship, you know. But she, you know, has her own demons.
Yeah.
She's been through some things too. So I thought it would be best to have him bond with someone who maybe wasn't going through the same things, but they could relate to each other. And so I think their hearts are damaged.
Yeah.
And I think they need each other in this way. I think she provides a good foil too, as far as her life is going to go off in a different trajectory. And he realizes that at the end. And, you know, I don't think the door is closed on them, but I don't see them, you know, getting married or anything. But
yeah.
I think it was nice to have, okay, maybe he could realize, you know, I could do the normal thing. You know, a family, a love affair doesn't have to be, you know, what I've witnessed my whole life.
Yeah. Okay. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about the impoverished neighborhood where Mark lives. He calls it the Patch. I was curious, was this based on a particular neighborhood? And then also connected to that, I think you were purposely vague in, at least regarding where Mark lives. I was guessing it was somewhere in eastern Pennsylvania, but I wasn't sure because it was never explicit. But I would be curious to hear you talk about that. I assume it was deliberately ambiguous.
It was ambiguous. But I think a lot of my writing is kind of located in this part of the state. I had
in central PA, not eastern PA.
Yeah, I had more of like a Harrisburg-y, Steelton,
okay,
sort of a place where, you know, a mid-sized town, maybe where the industry has left a little bit, and it's left like some impoverished, you know, neighborhoods. And this area called the Patch was, it's, you know, this sort of drug zone, this sort of 10 square block drug zone. And I think you'd find that in a lot of you know, 75,000 person cities, you'd find this sort of enclave of you know, sad stories and addiction. It wasn't really based on anything. My grandparents lived in a place in Scranton called The Plot, and I think that's where I pulled the name from.
Okay.
And it's kind of a rundown area now. I don't remember it that way, but I kind of like that the neighborhood had its own name and kind of signified that it was separate from the rest of town. So, yeah, that, no real town in mind, but it could be any town that's kind of been like Rust Belt-y or sort of mid-state-y sort of.
Was there a reason you didn't want to name a specific place?
Yeah, I don't want to locate. I don't want to, like, say this is it and what you're imagining, like, won't work for this. I am often deliberately vague in my settings. Now, the new novel, I'm working on a novel right now, it's Philly. It's all Philly. Mm-hmm. So it got a whole Philly thing. Mm-hmm. But for these others, if I could keep it kind of vague, as far as not vague sensory-wise or in terms of visualization, but vague in terms of it's not this exact place, I like that. In a lot of my short stories, I don't even name the characters. You know, a lot of my short stories, like the boy, the man, the cook, you know, whatever. I like my readers to be able to fill in as much as they can.
I gotcha. Now, many novels with teenage protagonists tend to get marketed these days as YA or young adult novels. Having read the novel, it doesn't appear to me to be aimed explicitly at a teen audience. That's just my assumption. I could be wrong, but I was curious, how did you decide how you ultimately wanted to market the novel and to not go the, you know, quote unquote YA route with it?
You know, I don't know how I leave that up to the publisher.
You know,
if they want to call it YA, I think they called my last novel YA, which was kind of like this in a way. I kind of view them as companion pieces.
Because they have young protagonists.
They have young protagonists. And I think for some people that's enough. You know, let's tap into the YA thing. I think the only YA thing about it is the age of the character.
Right.
So I don't really have too much of a say in that. YA, I think, would sell better. I should look at that, but I leave that up to them. I, you know, again, as a small press author, you do a lot of events and things like that, so that's on me. But I'm not super comfortable with marketing this to a YA audience. I think there's stuff in here that, you know, younger kids might not want to read.
Yeah, it's disturbing themes. There wasn't anything. Though in it, I mean, I assume that when you're writing a YA novel, you're sort of also conscious of the word choices and trying to keep the language at a certain level, and maybe I don't know. I've never written one, and I don't really read it, so I don't really know myself. It's just an assumption I'm making.
You mean word choice as far as like for the audience?
Yeah, for the audience to try to make it that maybe the language at a lower reading level than maybe a novel that has a teen protagonist but is you know, the language and that is you know, more at an adult reader's level and less at a teenager's level, you know, where you might not use a certain word.
Right. No, that doesn't enter my mind. My reader is an adult,
like in my mind.
Yeah. Like, you know, they always talk about your ideal reader, and my ideal reader would be an adult. You know, if a teenager would happen upon this, you know, great. But you know, my reader is always an adult. So maybe that's why I don't really, you know, pursue that YA market, because I think you would have to put those constraints on it.
Yeah, I would think.
And I don't think I want those constraints.
Yeah,
you know, on my work. Yeah.
I don't know if there might be folks of the opinion that any or maybe in like the marketing world that any novel with a teen protagonist of a certain length of novel is perfectly fine to market to that audience. I don't know, regardless of the themes. Or I guess not regardless of the themes, but I don't know that there are any themes in here that. I mean, I'm sure a high school class could unpack a lot from this novel in terms of a class discussion that, you know, would be productive without parents complaining about. I don't know. Maybe parents these days complain about a lot.
I think parents these days would not like this. I think that's where we are now.
Yeah.
Speaking as an ex high school person, I would not teach this to high school students.
In the current climate.
In the current climate, yeah, for sure. But you think back to the books we read, you know, in high school, you'd have a hard time reading some of them.
Yeah.
Now too. So
certainly,
it is a different climate now. You know, unfortunately. So.
Yeah. Well. What is, it's been out, the book's been out for a while now, since September.
Since September, yes.
What has the response been so far?
Response has been, you know, good. It's gotten great write-ups. It's going to be in a special issue of Kirkus. It was already reviewed in Kirkus Reviews. That's a review magazine. It's going to be in a new issue, like re-examining the best indies of the year before.
Oh, great.
So, yeah. I'm not making a ton of money off it, you know, that's what we're talking about. But
no, I was just curious the response of readers, if you...
The response has been good. I think most readers, you know, I have a core of readers, you know, you sell a couple hundred books, maybe 1,000 if you're lucky.
Yeah.
The core of them, I think a number of them like this book, like better than my other books. And I think it's because of the main character. I think he kind of carries the day for a lot of people. You know, the plot is like it follows a person's high school boy senior year. So it's territory we've been through before. But I think we cheer for this person because he seems like a good kid. He's up against a lot.
He's a very likable protagonist.
He's a pretty likable kid, you know. Now, my new novel, I have a new novel coming out next year. My main character is very unlikable.
So you've gone the opposite route.
He was a lot of fun to write after a nice kid.
Yeah, so. Yeah, bet. Interesting. Well, that's awesome. I wanted to ask you about, you had mentioned to me that you used the book for one of your novel writing classes. How did Eton College students in your class respond to the book?
We're right in the middle of it.
Oh, you're right in the middle.
Now. So
you've gotten some response.
I've gotten some response. You know, we're approaching it. I was unsure about doing it because, well, first of all, I didn't want anyone buying it. So I gave them all copies.
Wow.
And I just didn't want to have that money part of it ruining anything.
Yeah.
So we're trying to, and this is the same way we approach all books. We don't really talk so much about their content, but we look at them in terms of, oh, how did they do that? And why do you think this is placed here? So we look at it, a lot of it from the sort of crafty, structural sort of point of view. I think they can identify with the story because it's about a young person.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see. Now, tomorrow is day two.
It is hard to critique a novel of the person giving
it a
grade.
Every period I start with, like, okay, I am so distanced from this, you know, because when you put a book out, you have to have a thick skin.
Right.
And you know, I've gotten some horrible reviews, and it just doesn't affect me because, you know, in between this and today, there's a whole nother book that's done, and there's a book that's almost done. And a lot of times I'll forget, like, oh, who's the main character? I mean, I can remember his name, but the other people I have a hard time remembering because it's so far in the past. It's not really so far in the past, but in my writing past.
Yeah.
It's in the past.
Well, I know you're always working on stuff. I know you had mentioned, I think, a short story collection.
I have a short story that's ready to go.
Short story collection.
But I'm not pulling the trigger on that now just because... You know, when a book comes out, you kind of have to do things.
Right, to promote it.
Yeah, so I have one coming out about this time next year. It's coming out in the first quarter of 25.
That's a new novel you're talking
the
about?
The new novel about them.
So what's that one called?
That one's called Deaf Heaven.
Okay.
It's taken from a Shakespeare sonnet.
Okay.
So I pulled it from there. It has no teenagers, so I'm like super happy about that. And it's a main character, you know, he has a redemption arc, but at first he's not the
pretty
best
lousy
guy.
Person.
He has moments. So that will be out next year around this time.
Wonderful. I'll look forward to it. I enjoyed the novel very much, Kurt, and I will have a link posted on the description for the podcast, so the folks interested can go ahead and get themselves a copy.
All right, thank you. And if anyone's into the audiobook really turned out nicely.
Oh, is that out now?
Oh yeah, it's been out. Yeah,
it's been out. Okay.
I got to pick. They sent me all these tapes, audition tapes, and the person who did it did a really nice job.
Awesome. So. Awesome. That's great.
All right.
Thank you so much for coming back to the podcast,
man,
to talk to me, Kurt.
It's always a pleasure to come by.
Thank you for listening to the J-Pod, a High Library production. I'm your host, librarian Josh Cohen. Be sure to check back in with us for another episode from the Etown College community. If you have any ideas for future episodes or feedback, please email me at cohenjp@etown.edu.